at sludge, readsludge.com. That's readsludge. About DeLon, it just came out. Mysterious political group linked to New York Senator Martin DeLon is funded by big real estate. So check that out. It literally was just published on September 12th. And thank you again so much for listening to the Katie Halper Show. Thank you to Katie Unger and the Jewish Vote for talking to us. You can hear the Katie Halper Show every Wednesday at 7 p.m. on WBAI. That's WBAI.org or 99.5 FM. Bye.
The Reverend Dr. William Barber at Aretha Franklin's homegoing said her singing was liberation, revolution in the major key.
Her singing made you want to stand up and fight back against political lies and policy fraud. Her singing made you say to every system of oppression and to any narcissistic leader from the State House to the White House, no matter who you are, we will not accept anything less than respect. And if we have to vote to have respect, we'll vote. If we have to stand to have it, we'll stand. If we have to speak to have it, we'll speak. If we have to boycott to have it, we'll boycott. If we got to march to have it, we'll march. If we got to all go down to jail, it doesn't matter, because Aretha told us respect is non-negotiable.
This is listener-sponsored, non-commercial WBAI New York.
Hello, I'm Sierra Holman at WBAI in New York, reminding you that the New York State primaries are coming up this Thursday, September 13th. New York State polling sites open at 6 a.m. and they'll stay open until 9 p.m. For more information on where to vote in your district, head to vote.nyc.gov. You can also call the phone bank at 1-866-VOTE-NYC. You know, many people complain about public transportation, unaffordable rents, the high cost of living, and some worry about police accountability and the qualities of our schools. Well, now's the time to do something about it. Remember, local government directly affects you. Be the change you want to see in your community and vote this Thursday.
Hello, I'm David Rothenberg. Last spring, we presented Richard Hola's spellbinding show, simply called E, at the Commons right here at 388 Atlantic Avenue in Brooklyn. Because it was not only a sellout, but Richard earned a standing ovation, we determined that E merited a second showing. E, just the letter, it stands for Edith, the pugnacious and fascinating New York woman in this tale. It'll play again at the Commons on Sunday, September 16th at 3 o'clock. Tickets are $20 a person, a benefit for listener-sponsored BAI. WBAI will continue to be in on the start of this one-of-a-kind raconteur's newest and most vivid offering. Richard Hola's E, Sunday, September 16th at 3 p.m. here, right below our Crystal Studios at 388 Atlantic Avenue, Brooklyn. For ticket information, you can go to our website, WBAI.org. See you at the Commons.
And you're listening to radio station WBAI New York. It's 8 o'clock, time for another edition of Off the Hook.
We'll be right back.
And a very good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Hook. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you on this Wednesday evening, joined tonight by Kyle.
Yeah, that's me. I'm here. And,
Alex.
Hi. Good evening.
And Voltaire.
Greetings.
Wow. So here we are on this Wednesday. Put the book down, Kyle. Put the book down.
No, I'm just...
We've got the Bob Woodward... haven't had a conversation in 2 days now because everyone's reading this book.
I got to get through chapter 40. It's my third cup of coffee, and I've been reading straight through.
It's good stuff. No, mm-hmm. it's riveting. I'll say that.
Yes.
But we do have a show to do. We do have some things to take care of, and hopefully we'll take some phone calls. The phone number to take note of, 347-335-0818. We'd love to hear from you, and you can also write to us, oth@2600.com. Hey, an update to a story that we reported on last week, a disturbing story concerning a missing person in the hacker community named Arjen Kempfris. Again, I'm probably pronouncing that wrong. It's a Dutch hacker. Has been to Hope, is well known in the community, and has been missing since August 20th. Out of a city known as Bodø in Norway, another place that I've been to. You've been to as well, Kyle. It's a place with an airport. It's a place that's fairly near the sea. And that is the last place anyone has seen this guy. Now, there have been some developments in that a signal was received on his cell phone. This is interesting. The signal was received on his cell phone in the southern part of the country, a place called... Vekesa, I believe is how you pronounce it. It's about 50 kilometers south of Stavanger. Now, what's interesting about this is that Arjen was supposed to get on a train in Bodø heading to Trondheim, which is to the south. Now, if you were to take a train to Trondheim and then continue from Trondheim to Oslo and then continue from Oslo to the last stop, you would wind up in Stavanger, which is near where this cell phone was turned on. I don't believe there is one train that does the whole thing. You would have to take the train to Trondheim, then a train to Oslo, then a train to Stavanger. But conceivably, it's possible. It does seem to be a route that a train could go on that would go all the way down there. Again, you know, I'm just spitballing here as far as... throwing out theories and ideas as to what might have happened. Now, his phone was turned on in that small place, Vekesa, which is about 50 kilometers south of Stavanger. But a German SIM card was inserted after the phone was on for 20 minutes. Now, I was getting conflicting reports as to whether or not his PIN was entered. The consensus right now seems to be that it was not. Some people were saying that it was. Of course, if his PIN was entered, that would indicate that... that was, in fact, him. But if it was not entered and the phone was on for 20 minutes and then a German SIM card was put into it, kind of leans towards maybe somebody finding the phone and putting a SIM card into it, or maybe something else. Who knows? Very little information is being given to the public, so it's kind of hard to do anything but speculate. Now, yesterday, something a bit more disturbing was discovered. They found his... a bunch of his missing property. A fisherman found some of his belongings, and that was near Bodø. They're found in the sea between the towns of Fosk and Rognan in Nordland country. They didn't reveal what the belongings were, but he was traveling with a portable kayak, so it is possible that he set out from that area and his belongings were found fairly nearby where that might have taken place. But, you know, it's very frustrating because we're just getting bits and pieces, and the authorities, you know, didn't seem to be taking it all that seriously. In fact, I heard a lot of speculation that perhaps he's doing this deliberately, that he's trying to stay off the radar. And he knows how to do that, but there's too many disturbing things here. Not the least of which, here, I'm going to hand you this story. this is just typical of the stories that are coming out. Alex, upon looking at that story, what do you see that's wrong with it?
Well, it has Julian Assange on the front cover.
Not that, only yes. one picture, it has two pictures of Julian Assange. Oh, and no pictures of the guy who's missing.
And they're almost the same picture.
And every single story I read just kind of lapses into Julian Assange's story about how he's being holed up in the embassy. And that's an interesting story, and we've been following it for years. But for God's sake, this is a story about this guy. And, you know, if you look at the headlines, it's basically... You know, Assange comes first, this guy comes second, or here's a strange disappearance of WikiLeaks associate, you know, and that is not the story. It is a story, but it's not that story. We need to focus on this guy, and it's just, you know, being eclipsed constantly by something else.
Can I ask you a question about that story? The belongings that were found by a fisherman, they were found in the water.
That's my understanding.
All right. If that understanding is correct... And let's say there was some kind of capsizing of his kayak. That does not necessarily jive at all with the idea of a cell phone turning up near Stavanger.
That's exactly true. How does a cell phone get from not the northern part of Norway, but pretty far up, all the way down to the southern part of Norway? And here's something else. I did a little research on, and this is something that they could be telling us. The currents flow upward over there. So, you know, even if somehow... something floated all the way down. Well, it doesn't happen that way. The currents go northerly at that particular point, from what I've been able to understand. So, yeah, there is something, there is more going on here, but we don't know what it is. And unfortunately, it's being eclipsed by all this conspiracy talk about how they want to get Julian, and this guy was, you know, somebody who... I don't even know how close he was to him. You know, he may have met him just a couple of times, or he may have, you know, done something for WikiLeaks, but I don't think that's the story. The story is this guy is missing. Is he hiding? Was he abducted for some other reason? Is he lost someplace? You know, that is what we have to be focusing on. And unfortunately, I'm not seeing enough of that. And as a result, not enough information is getting out where, you know, the hacker mindset could prove helpful here. The cell phone alone. If we knew more about how that was detected exactly, what happened, was the PIN code entered? You know, not being able to get a straight answer on that is frustrating because that reveals all kinds of information. And if the PIN code was turned on, it could explain why the authorities aren't pursuing this as strongly as they should. You know, if you look up his name, there's only a handful of stories about this, most of which have been provoked by people in the hacker community.
I mean, more important than the WikiLeaks connection here, mm-hmm. I mean, is the fact that Arjun authored the tome Information Security for Journalists.
Yes.
That means that he's probably in intimate contact with journalists, perhaps of working on some interesting stories. That has more relevance to me than a tangential link to WikiLeaks. I think that's far more important than this. I mean, I don't see any indication in this story, and I haven't read the entirety of it, of what his last contact or meaningful contact was with WikiLeaks.
I mean, how about this? Why Bodø? Why was he there? Was he? I mean, it's a nice place, but I wouldn't, you know, take a vacation there. It's basically a midway point to other places. But maybe there was something there that attracted him. But what was it? You know, the fact that he was supposed to get on a train the day he went missing. Okay, surveillance cameras, they're everywhere. So did he get to the train station or not? I haven't seen any clear answer to that. There's all kinds of things that could be looked into here, and you know, knowing the information would be extremely helpful.
I've heard as well that Europe does have a lot of CCTV.
They absolutely do. Yes.
Yeah. I'm really curious if the phone is being examined any further than what you're initially saying is coming out. As far as just media in general or where he left off, as far as using it, there's probably. Sure, layers and layers of security and difficulty there, but maybe media cards or just anything, any kind of clue as to what exactly he was doing right before he was separated from that device. And that goes for the other belongings, too. You weren't able to list them, but I'm really curious what other stuff, electronics or otherwise, might be kind of an indicator as to what was going on or, you know, how it came to be that he was separated from those.
Yeah, I can't tell you anything about the belongings. I can tell you how long Julian was in the embassy for. The story goes into that, but it doesn't give you information on the belongings that were found, which, you know, and the other thing is the belongings would include his cell phone, most likely, if they you know, that's something that you would generally have on you if you were going on a kayak.
Well, you may have had more than one. You know, there could be a lot of different scenarios there.
It's, a lot doesn't add up here. How does his phone get to the southern part of the country and his other belongings wind up in the water in the northern part? We need answers here. We'll continue following it and hopefully, come to some kind of a conclusion here. If you want to follow the story, his name is Arjen Kamprijs, and I'm sorry again for pronouncing it wrong, Arjen Kamprijs. And, it's just another thing that we are paying attention to here. But other things are going on as well. Some rather disturbing news today, more disturbing news out of Europe. We mentioned this copyright directive that was on the table. Well, the EU has approved the controversial copyright directive, which includes an internet link tax and upload filter. It was a controversial piece of legislation intended to update online copyright laws for the internet age. And usually when you have a phrase like that, it doesn't go in a very good direction. This directive was originally rejected by MEPs in July following criticism of two key provisions, Articles 11 and 13, which were dubbed the link tax and the upload filter by critics. In Parliament, an updated version of the directive was approved, rather, along with amended versions of Articles 11 and 13. And the vote was 438 in favor, 226 against. It wasn't exactly close. They say the fight is far from finished, but, I'm hearing that a lot, and it's getting rather depressing. The fallout will be far-reaching. It'll take quite a while to settle. The directive itself still faces a final vote in January 2019, although it's very unlikely to be rejected at that point. After that, it'll need to be implemented by individual EU member states who could very well vary significantly in how they choose to interpret the text. But anyway, the most important parts, as I mentioned, are Articles 11 and 13. Article 11 is intended to give publishers and papers a way to make money when companies like Google link to their stories, allowing them to demand paid licenses. And Article 13 requires certain platforms like YouTube and Facebook to stop users sharing unlicensed copyrighted material. Now, already YouTube is a massive pain as far as that goes, because they overdo it. They overdo it so much. There are people, worried about hearing a snippet of a song in a passing car when they're making a documentary that they're uploading to YouTube. I've heard stories of people who are covering revolutions, uprisings, and they're filming all kinds of things, but the thing that stops them is a clip of a song going by in a car, and they have to either reshoot something or delete it because of that. It's insane. It goes against everything that copyright is supposed to stand for, and it's yet another example of the abuse. Now, critics of the copyright directive say these provisions are disastrous. In the case of Article 11, they note that attempts to tax platforms like Google News for sharing articles have repeatedly failed, and that the system would be ripe to abuse by copyright trolls. Article 13, of course, is even worse. The legislation requires that platforms proactively work with rights holders to stop users uploading copyrighted content. The only way to do so would be to scan all data being uploaded to sites like YouTube and Facebook. And that would create an incredible burden for small platforms and could be used as a mechanism for widespread censorship. And that's why figures like Wikipedia founder Jimmy Wales, World Wide Web inventor Tim Berners-Lee came out so strongly against the directive. And, really, just listen to those guys, because they're the ones who invented all this. Why don't you listen to them and take their opinion a little bit more seriously? If they say it's going to break the net, it's probably going to break the net. Well, of course, the people backing these provisions say the arguments above are the result of scaremongering by big U.S. tech companies eager to keep control of the web's biggest platforms. They point to existing laws and amendments to the directive as proof that it won't be abused in this way. And these include exemptions for sites like GitHub and Wikipedia from Article 13, exceptions to the link tax that allow for the sharing of mere hyperlinks and individual words describing articles without constraint. but I don't think many of us are buying that. It's yet another example of control being exercised over the things that we take for granted and making the net a whole lot more unpleasant and difficult to work with. Walter.
Yeah, and even with the new additions, like when it comes time for the member states to implement these laws, they're going to be overly broad and not and then they'll be just as part of the reason why this passes, because the recording and motion picture industry spend so much money on lobbying, like on the front page of all the major newspapers across Europe, where ads for this to pass these bills. So now when the same thing's going to happen when it comes to the member states, they're going to spend millions of dollars lobbying the member states to implement it in the most harsh way.
Yeah, and you know, with respect to implementation, when really what happens with these European Union directives is this is essentially a statement from the European Union that says you need now to enact national legislation. It's called transposing legislation, and each one is going to do it with a different wrinkle. And some states, you know, may balk at this as well. And the idea here is really to harmonize laws within the European Union, but it never really works out that way. And it's these kinds of overarching directives that come from the European Union that then require some kind of legislation to be ramrodded down the throats of these national legislatures that the people of these countries may not agree with, that gave rise to the notion of Brexit and rise to the notion that the European Union is taking away our sovereignty and the right to make our own laws in our own country. This is a very good example of the kind of idiocy that we see from these Eurocrats constantly making rules that they shouldn't in areas where they shouldn't be entering.
Eurocrats?
Eurocrats.
Okay, I like that word.
You like that word? I can use it again and again and again.
Did you make it up? Or?
No, this is in common parlance. Probably, uh-huh. You can probably look it up, actually. You know, basically anybody that lives in Brussels. But in any event, I mean, there's just so much wrong with this. When we covered this a couple of months ago, I remember thinking that this couldn't pass today because it's so idiotic. It's so unworkable in so many ways, too. And there's so much wrong with this. There's so much potential for misuse, for fraud, for abuse. I mean, copyrights are inherently tricky things because they don't last forever, number one. So how do you determine when a copyright expires? Are these mechanisms that are filtering content going to determine, you know, the date in which a copyright was issued, the date that it expires? Is it going to look for all these things? And what about the idea that, you know, let's say we are criticizing a particular newspaper or a particular book and we're using an excerpt of it, mm-hmm. and that's perfectly fine under copyright law in the European Union and in the United States with respect to the fair use doctrine. So how are these algorithms going to determine whether or not something is a fair use? The only way they can do it is the way that YouTube is doing this now, which is to shift the burden onto the user to make an argument that the fair use doctrine applies. And that's unfortunately not really fair to the user. It will have a deleterious effect on the debate that we have and dialogue that we have on the internet. And frankly, I don't really understand how smaller companies are going to be implementing this unless they're going to be beholden to larger entities that are doing this, at which point all the information that is going back and forth between users and websites is also going to be passing through a third party. And that's really not great for freedom of speech and dialogue as well. Oh, I can keep going on this if you want me to. I mean, you know, one other issue is with respect to the usage of these types of filtering mechanisms, one of the things that you think they're going to be doing is creating a hash, right, of a copyrighted work, creating, you know, using MD5 or whatever, you know, algorithm you want to do to create some kind of hash of a work. But if they're using hashing, like companies do to detect child pornography, all you have to do is shift one bit and an entire hash changes. So, you know, from a technical standpoint, I could see this with respect to copyright being really difficult to implement.
Well, on the subject of child pornography, I happen to have a story here concerning stamping out the spread of child sexual abuse material, which apparently is known as CSAM, C-S-A-M. I didn't know that. It's a priority for big internet companies. It's also a difficult and harrowing job for those on the front line. human moderators who have to identify and remove abusive content. So Google, as of last week, released free AI software designed to help those individuals and hopefully the children being abused. Most tech solutions in this domain work by checking images and videos against a catalog of previously identified abusive material. This sort of software is known as a crawler. It's an effective way to stop people sharing known previously identified CSAM. Really, I never heard that before. It can't catch material that hasn't already been marked as illegal. For that, human moderators have to step in and reveal content themselves. Google's AI tool triages flagged material, helping moderators work faster. And using the company's expertise in machine vision, it assists moderators by sorting flagged images and videos and prioritizing the most likely CSAM content for review. It should allow for a much quicker reviewing process. In one trial, says Google, the AI tool helped a moderator take action on 700% more CSAM content over the same time period. This is a hard thing to argue, but it's also fairly easy to expand this into other realms, other domains where images might be objectionable. Let's say, because it's a good example, Tiananmen Square. Let's say images of that, of the pro-democracy movement, or maybe, you know, the Arab Spring, or all kinds of things that can be considered controversial that the authorities would prefer that you not spread around. Well, using a tool like this, it would be fairly trivial to just go out and find all the images, maybe track down the people who posted those images, but make sure that the images themselves do not spread. And, while always the first example of this is something that we can all agree on, the ones that follow, those are the ones that you have to worry about. And they're inevitable.
Yeah, this makes me think of the conversation about war crimes and the instance where collateral murder was released. Imagine any kind of military footage or footage from operations in the Mideast or anywhere somehow being something that a private entity steps in and filters on behalf of the U.S. government. So then all of a sudden, anybody posting or reposting video of reporters being killed by our soldiers, maybe the audio or whatever it is, it gets flagged, then you immediately stifle the ability for people to show what has been going on overseas.
You know, I think the danger of what you're talking about already exists, Emmanuel. If you think about the current way that child pornography is flagged right now, and I haven't called it CSAM or whatever you called it.
I never heard that before.
No, not at all. We always call it CP, child pornography. Right?
Well, yeah, I don't know why we need initials for these things.
I don't know. Because it's like, you know, George Washington Bridge being called GWB. It's the same amount of syllables.
Well, that makes sense.
No, it's not. It doesn't. GWB. There's W is a letter with three syllables.
Yeah, but I don't know why it may. It just does.
You think so? George Washington Bridge is just as fast to say. Anyhow, to get back to
BQE. Berkeley, okay.
Yeah, yeah. NCMEC is another acronym here. NCMEC stands for the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, and they track child pornography. They have the largest repository of child pornography, hopefully, on the earth. And the way in which they track this is that child pornography, once it's flagged, is sent over to NCMEC. They create a hash of this. Anything that's uploaded, whether it's to Facebook, to Google, to YouTube, Instagram, whatever the hell it is, even things like Google Drive and these cloud-based storage providers, is usually scanned. A hash is created of the files. That hash is then compared to the hash of child pornography. If there's a match, then a notification is sent over to NCMEC. NCMEC then will send a notification over to either FBI or to state or local law enforcement. They investigate the matter. Especially if there are a lot of matches to these hashes, because they've got this gigantic database of child pornography. So this system for monitoring images and things already exists. I think this innovation from Google is generally a good thing if it doesn't overflag. And overflagging child pornography can have disastrous consequences for people's lives. Think about what could happen if something is erroneously flagged, mm-hmm. and it goes over to NCMEC, and then an FBI investigation is launched, and then they show up at your house, and they take your computers, and they take them for months, and you're arrested, and then all of a sudden, you're $200,000 or $300,000 in legal fees in the hole trying to prove that this flag through this algorithm was erroneous. On the other hand, my wife works in the prosecution of sex crimes and in particular crimes against children. She has to look at these things. It's very traumatic. And when I was a law clerk at the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces, we dealt with a lot of appeals of child pornography convictions. And we had to look at child pornography because one of the big issues then was whether or not the pornography was real or if it was rendered by a machine. Because if it was rendered by a machine, you couldn't be convicted for the possession of child pornography. There was no actual child in there, even if it was an image that looked like a child. And all of this is really draining when you have to look at this. It's very emotionally disturbing. And when you do this day in and day out, it has a real deleterious, I'll use that word again, effect on your personality. And within these institutions where people have to do this on a daily basis, there really aren't support programs to help you out.
What about people who want to do that on a daily basis? You have to get a fair number of those kind of people applying for the job in the first place.
That's a good point. That is a good point.
But yeah, rather non-serious contribution to this, Nick Mick, that's not exactly a name that puts fear into your heart. You're being investigated by Nick Mick.
Well,
you need something better than that.
They're doing the hash matching, right? National, or a lot of people call it the National Center, the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. They do a lot of really good work. I mean, child pornography is a vicious, horrible, heinous crime. It needs to be stamped out.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that it's really dangerous territory if we are going to rely on algorithms and not human validation to make these calls.
But the other thing, though, that I think needs to be addressed is that people are not aware that when they use Google Drive, their images are being scanned or their text is being scanned. It's being monitored and sent to authorities.
Absolutely.
That's something that needs to be, child pornography is bad. I get it. But that is also something that is extremely troubling
and
dangerous.
Well, I'll tell you, we dealt with a case in the defense of somebody who was investigated for the possession of child pornography, and he was not... he was not solely in charge of this particular computer. Mm-hmm. This computer was in a doctor's office where tons of people were coming and going. And then there was a hard drive that was taken in and out. And, it becomes a really, really tricky issue here because misclassification of child pornography can ruin someone's life.
Of course.
To go back to what we were dealing with at the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces, a lot of what we were seeing there was back in the days when people were trading around CD-ROMs, and these CD-ROMs had images burned onto them. They're ROMs, read-only memory, right? So soldiers who were out to sea, didn't have an internet connection, wanted some kind of self-enjoyment, is one way of putting it. So they would burn these CDs, trade them around, and sometimes on these discs, out of the 10,000 images that were there, there were one or two that looked like they could have been child pornography. And you essentially waive your Fourth Amendment rights when you become a service member. So you don't have the normal expectations of privacy, and anybody can come inspect your room, inspect your barracks, look in your computer, especially if folders are open and disks are out. Well, they would look at these disks, they would find these files, they would arrest the soldiers, charge them, court-martial them, and appeal it. But the sad thing is they didn't want to be in possession of this child pornography. It's a strict liability offense. And now they were what would ultimately happen is they would be convicted, they would be sentenced to confinement in prison, dishonorably discharged from the military, 19, 20 years old, and branded a sex offender for the rest of their lives.
Because somebody gave them a CD-ROM with an image on it.
That's exactly right.
Yeah, at some point I think we have to, let sanity take over and say, that's not the same thing as abuse. That's different. That's something that you easily could have no control over. In the hysteria, sometimes that little fact is lost.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't really subscribe to the idea that, I think this is a lot of feel-good stuff. It makes people feel better, but I don't think there's really a panacea for, electronically, managing this. I think it's something that's always going to be there. It's like any taboos. The more you compartmentalize it and say this is bad and you can't do this, people will find ways and they'll find alternate methods, like you said, inadvertent or not. I don't know. I'm a little critical, and especially when it's ruining people's lives. I mean, child pornography is a trigger word that can just, you know, just wreak havoc just by the perception. And I don't know, I've really, really mixed feelings, especially as an artist. And just in general, I think that, you know, the fallout of having everyone's files so rifled through, it just is, it doesn't feel like you have control over your artifact.
Yeah, and it's worth pointing out, if people actually care about, like, helping child abuse, the vast, vast majority of child abuse happens not from, like, strangers, but from, parents and members of the same household. And the same people that are, like, are the most, like, gung-ho about fighting child pornography are the same people that are cutting welfare services.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we could go on. This could be, like, a two-hour show. But, I mean, you look at, like, the Catholic Church right now, they have some serious issues, and they have done nothing but ensured for initiatives that destroy the rights of people like that don't necessarily fit that model and aren't a part of that, and they've closed off an entire segment of the community and created an unhealthy environment where power and authority sort of can be used to exploit actual vulnerable children.
Yeah, and if you want to fight this, attack it at the source. Attack it where it's happening. And there are plenty of ways of finding out where that's happening. And when you see cover-ups to keep from happening, and yeah, you know, images those, but you also have to ask yourself, the technology that we're introducing, how can that be misused for everything else? And I just see so much potential here for these AI tools to be used to control us, to monitor us, to put the fear of the Lord into us.
Yeah, that's something we said before, and I just want to reiterate that it's like, it is these taboos, these things that have a visceral connotation that make people feel like, you know, this is the right, you know, we should do this and not think about necessarily we deem edge or other sorts of fallout, like edge cases or the consequences, and just have this massive cleanse. But, you know, do we ever get to a full clean internet? And once we get there, as I said, you know, are we ready for the ways that people find around that now cleansed platform, whether it's Google or anyone, right? You know, as you said, Voltaire, are we really looking, are we addressing the issues in society? And again, if we're only going to have nuclear families, look how that worked for the Catholic Church. Look where that gets you. You create a sickness. You create an environment where it's okay to abuse people that are like same sex oriented or otherwise, you know, transgender, all of these different things that have changed, and something that, you know, a lot of the world has accepted, at least the West, and in a lot of cases, become sort of complete relegation, and then are closed down. People don't have resources. They don't get to talk to people. They don't get to express themselves. They don't get to be themselves. They just sit around and are at the effect of hegemony. And then you act shocked and surprised when people have manifestations of their kinks and so on coming out, because you're taking away anything that's even closely considered, you know, God help you if you have a diaper kink or something.
Wow, well, that's quite a note to to examine. Yeah, it's definitely an issue that I think is going to be affecting far more than the intended target, and one that we as hackers need to focus on. But you know, keeping with the topic of Google, how has Google intruded upon your life this week? I think that could be a weekly feature. And you know, one thing I noticed this week, you know what? I'm not going to say what I have because I believe in privacy. I believe in keeping certain things to myself. But I'm going to come up with substitutes and achieve the same effect that way. I have a Mercedes, and my Mercedes has hubcaps, and I hire somebody to occasionally polish the hubcaps. That's believable, right? Okay, so I have not had my hubcaps polished in a good couple of years. So I asked the person who last polished my hubcaps, are you still in the business of polishing hubcaps? Could you do that for me? I'm still reachable in the same way. And the person wrote back saying, oh, no, I'm sorry. I have a full schedule. I can no longer help you out with your hubcaps. You'll have to find somebody else. Now, I used one of my Gmail accounts for this. I know by law you only allowed one, but I have several. No, that's not true, but it will be someday, I'll bet. So I basically communicated using that particular account. And I read the reply. And then what surprised me was seeing what was under the reply from this person. And the basic gist of it is that there were three choices. And they were suggested responses to what he had said to me, such as, sorry to hear that, or thanks for answering, I'll find somebody else, things like that. Basically, it read my damn email, and not only did it read it, it interpreted what it was saying to me and how I might respond. And I just, you know, I didn't see this one coming, but apparently this is the new normal now. And I don't know how long this has been going on for. I don't really use Gmail all that much, but have you guys noticed this?
Yeah, I mean, I think that their natural language processing has gotten really, really good. What's interesting is, you know, they have made a decision to stop scanning the content of emails for targeted advertising.
I think they did scan the content to do this.
For advertising purposes, for targeted advertising purposes, but they're obviously still scanning the content for natural language processing and giving you these types of recommendations. I mean, I remember...
Is that supposed to make me feel better that they're not scanning it for advertising? They're just scanning it to be creepy now?
Yes, I think it is supposed to make you feel better. It obviously isn't. I think you should send that complaint to the complaint line.
What leapt out for me was the connection to the assistant. In other words, the sort of AI thing. We reported on this a couple of months ago. Basically, it was a thing that had made calls and would schedule appointments for or on your behalf, sort of like a personal assistant would. But this version was in software and it was sort of attached to that platform. And I'm just kind of curious. It seemed to me when I looked at it, that it was like the manifestation of that that just sort of pushed to Gmail. A lot of the answers were short and very glib and terse and not very informative or friendly or anything like you, me. I noticed this as well in an account that I have access to. So it just seems a little kind of early, but by having it integrated with Gmail, assume that's on your phone and you're managing it there, and the assistant is something you can activate and speak to while you're on the go, you could potentially be doing sort of response, and then that could easily be flipped into something that's doing that for you, maybe when you set some hours, like, you know, I'm away, have my assistant queue tasks or something. Yeah, it just seems like the early steps of that.
Yeah, because what you just described sounds like one of the early away messages, but this is a step beyond that. And like you said, it's the early stages. What's this going to look like, you know, a bit down the road and, you know, a few years? Are we going to be communicating with anybody anymore, or are we just going to have our accounts answering questions for us? Walter?
Yeah, even though, like as Alex said, they're not using or at least they claim they're not scanning emails for the sell advertisement, they're still, it doesn't mean they're not using your data for commercial purposes, because by collecting all this data about your email, their like AI services are based on having a ton of data collected, and they're selling those AI services back to governments, like in their smart city initiatives and surveillance projects, where you need a ton of AI data. So basically, like, AI is data is kind of like the new oil, and when they have a monopoly on that, they can charge usurious rates on governments.
Yeah, and building on that point that you made, you know, this is a marked shift, I think, in terms of the type of data that's valuable too, because what they were looking for before was content about you and your life and what your preferences were. And I think what we're seeing now is a shift from content, because they've already got enough content. Everybody has seen what we're doing for many years, seen what we're doing with our instant messages, our emails, et cetera, and they're shifting more towards behavioral analytics. So this is data about your behavior. How do you respond to this person when he asks you this question? That, in the aggregate, over, you know, a billion people, becomes very, very valuable information about human behavior. But on the subject of human behavior, and talking about Gmail in particular, years ago, this is sort of a funny story, when I was using PGP to communicate through a Gmail account, obviously the content was encrypted, so Gmail couldn't read it, but I was still getting targeted advertisements. And I thought that the targeted advertisements were, on the one hand, kind of brilliant, on the other hand, a really horrible stereotype of people that use encryption, because the advertisements I were getting were for home cleaning services. So, you know, if you were using PGP in a Gmail and sending encrypted email, I think there was an implicit assumption that you were some kind of slob who needed your home to be cleaned by a professional. It was hilarious. I was constantly getting home cleaning services. I would never put that in any content, but encrypted messages for some reason triggered
this is about hubcaps, okay? I want to stay
with
the hubcaps. Okay. Again, I don't own a Mercedes. Right. I don't think I even have hubcaps on anything I own. But the point is, you know, in your particular case, Alex, I don't know. Maybe home cleaning is just the generic thing they send out to everybody because everybody, maybe, you know, has a dirty place at some point and needs to clean it.
Perhaps.
I don't know. But I'd like to hear if other people, you know, maybe got things like that. But what I'd like to do, maybe we could engage in some kind of experiment here because we both have access to Gmail. Like, that's a big thing. Wow. Yeah, we're in the elite club. We have access to Gmail. What if we came up with some of the most bizarre messages back and forth just to see, you know, if we can blow Gmail's mind and have it suggest all kinds of things to us on how we should respond to that. You know, just pick the most outrageous scenario you can imagine.
Like, do you still sell sarin nerve gas?
Okay, there's that. That brings up other issues. But, you know, right. I was thinking more like I'm going to be launching to space tomorrow. And I was just wondering if there's anything that you'd like from Mars before I come back. I don't know, just to see what Google suggests. But it, you know, your sarin gas thing is also a good idea. But I wonder, with something like that, would we in fact be triggering other features that might alert authorities?
Perhaps.
Now, you know, all kinds of plots and schemes that are being discussed between two people, Gmail to Gmail. You know, take it to its logical conclusion and come up with something really horrible. Would you get a visit? Would you be put on a list as a lawyer? What do you think?
I think it's quite possible. I do. I think it's quite possible. If you have these kinds of communications where you're talking about things that could reasonably lead to some kind of terrorist activity, that yes, I think it could lead to further scrutiny. And at the very least.
Keep in mind that people have the perception when they're using Gmail that it's secure, that only they and the people they're sending to can read the mail. But that's not the case, is it?
No, it's not the case. I mean, there's plenty of people that can read the mail, especially email when it's sent unencrypted mm-hmm. over the internet.
And that's, you know, that's the case with most email providers, absolutely.
That's right.
But it's just, you know, in their particular case, they you know, they're kind of big on pushing privacy. And to see this used in this particular way where your words are being analyzed, just think people need to know that that's what's happening.
That's true. I mean, and this is something I've been saying for a while, that if Google wanted to encrypt email worldwide, this is really something that they could probably implement really easily. At least Gmail to Gmail, they could implement some kind of certificate-based encryption system where everybody has each other's certificates, or you can look it up based on the email system, and then you automatically encrypt. It would, however, defeat the business model that they have created.
Absolutely. And you are getting something for nothing. So, you know, that there's that to consider. There's always a price. Let me just give out the phone number so people can join the conversation in the time we have left. 347-335-0818. Area code 347-335-0818. Give us a call. Let us know what's on your mind. It can be about the topics we've discussed, or it can be about something completely different. Again, 347-335-0818. Voltaire.
Yeah, to Alex's point about the Gmail could easily implement like a PGP-based system and secure millions of people's emails, they actually, Google went out of their way to stop the system from developing. They announced a project like that and then immediately put it on the back burner and basically turned it into vaporware. But because it's announced, there's less development on it because people were assuming that this is already a solved problem.
We'll wait for Google to do it for us.
Yeah, exactly.
That kind of thing, yeah.
Because we're also helpless. Yeah, we need the help. Okay, we have a phone call. Good evening. You're on Off the Hook. Go ahead.
Hey, how you doing, guys?
What's up?
Yeah, from my perspective, I think Google is wonderful, man. You know, I remember, because I'm probably like little younger than you, I'm like 40, so I remember when I was in college like 20 years ago, mm-hmm. Yahoo was the big thing, and then AOL came in, and 2006, YouTube came out, you know, Google came out around that time, and it just took over, man.
Well,
but
yeah,
I love Google because, you know, you have Google Chrome, which actually alleviated the, I guess, the lag time for like the regular Google as far as web browsing. So, you know, they had Google Chrome now. And I've been using that ever since. Every phone I've had, even going on the computer with the library or the internet cafe, no one uses IE no more. You know, well, everything is Google.
Yeah, Firefox still, you know, still is giving them a run for their money.
Have a good day, man.
All right, thanks. Thanks for calling. That's a lot of praise there for Google, and you'll see that a lot in the tech community.
Yeah, you know, he brings up an interesting point too. You know, Google came in, I think, around 2004 or so when they created Gmail.
Mm-hmm.
I think an interesting point to make here is that back
well, they
when,
were around before that. They were
well,
around,
that's true, but yeah. Gmail, I think, came
Gmail
out
was
around
a big thing,
2004
yes.
when you needed. Remember, you needed an invite to get a Gmail account.
That's right.
But here's the thing that was really interesting about Gmail is that you actually got something. You got a bargain, right? You knew that they were reading your emails, but you got space.
Mm-hmm.
You got, you know, storage space, which was actually quite valuable back in 2004.
True.
So you were getting something for that exchange. There was an exchange of your privacy for space. Now, with space being virtually limitless, it's incredibly cheap. We are definitely getting less of a bargain when we're giving away our privacy like this.
Yeah, but we're used to it. We have another phone call. Good evening. You're on Off the Hook. Go ahead.
Hi.
Hi. What's on your mind?
So going back to the talking earlier about like the content ID stuff on YouTube and all that stuff, I know we've talked a lot about the issues regarding just whether that system should be in place in the first place, you know, because it obviously hinders a lot of, you know, charging for links and stuff is crazy and all that oversight is too much. But one of the big problems, too, is just the system itself doesn't actually work that well, and there's almost no human oversight. So, for example, you know, years back I had some music that I put online, completely original, but YouTube's content ID system, for some reason, you know, it's a heuristic system, it saw something that it thought was copyright information, and it flagged my original music, original recordings with no copyright material in them at all. And because there's no human oversight, it took 2 or 3 weeks before I could get through to a human to actually say, oh, yes, this is yours, and put my videos back online.
Wow. That's terrible.
I think that's something that happens to a lot of people. I don't think that's, you know, if you do a Google search of content ID, it's dozens or hundreds of reports of this kind of thing happening. For even if you have the license, it can often be an issue. I've had colleagues who have legally licensed music. They are paying their royalties. They've got the license. They've got their sync license and their master license, and they put it on YouTube. YouTube's content ID system just goes off, and it says, hey, submit the right paperwork, but by the time your video is back online, you know, if it's 2 weeks, that's, for a lot of content creators, that's a big problem, because that's 2 weeks that you're not monetized.
Yeah, it's a big deal, because any scheme like we described and discussed tonight, any scheme is going to be automated from their perspective. They can't have the overhead, as much as I sort of agree with Alex that there should be some human involvement for different cases. I really highly doubt that's in the business model. And YouTube specifically is growing so fast, and our bandwidth, our ability to get content there is growing exponentially all the time, that there's really no way they could build something that was even really a hybrid. Everything has to be automated from their business perspective alone. So that's absolutely a frustration and an attribute of a lot of these entities, that you have to know someone. You have to have a friend that works there, basically, to get any of these companies' attention in a lot of ways.
Yeah, the caller brings up a really excellent point here, something I didn't think about when I was reading that article earlier today, but yeah, absolutely right. Copyright can be licensed, and how are any of these filters going to determine whether or not you're a licensed, authorized user of this particular copyright? And people spend a lot of time negotiating rights to music or to film or to images, and it will absolutely be flagged. There's no way for any of these filtering systems to account for independent, private, legal agreements between two entities or two people for their use of copyrighted material. It's going to be a complete disaster if this is implemented.
In other words, it's not really an active system. It's once implemented, it's sort of there, and it's in an opaque filter and an unattended one at that.
Well, thanks for the call. Anything else you wanted to say?
No, that's all I wanted to bring up. Thanks.
All right, thanks. You know, it's it brings up a lot of memories, though, because we've had our run-ins with YouTube, just with just about every company out there. But I remember one in particular with, you know, our friend Virgil, who gives talks occasionally at our conferences. He gave a talk at one of the Hope conferences where he was playing an excerpt of a story about him. He did something. I forget exactly what it was about. I think it involved Wikipedia. He played an excerpt from the Colbert Report. And it got flagged immediately when it was put up on YouTube for people to see his talk. In fact, our account got suspended because we dared to violate Viacom's copyright. But the story was about him. It was his story. He was showing it to people, yet somehow it didn't belong to him, and we had to blank it out in order for people to. But then the talk didn't make sense because he was referring to something that he did, because somebody else talked about it and they had a license. We were forbidden. And the ultimate irony is that Viacom didn't make that available anywhere else. They just had it logged. And things like that happen all the time. Another thing I'm involved in right now is archiving of old videotapes. I've been kind of manic about this since the 1980s, recording historical things on television or old episodes of TV shows. And what I'd like to do, because I've inadvertently captured a lot of history, including commercials of all sorts, things that I might even have the only copy of, I would like for people to crowdsource that, look at each video and say, hey, that's me in that commercial there. And we can, make clips and have a kind of archive. You can't upload it. As soon as you upload it, it's flagged because, somebody thinks that, you're going to be taking advantage of copyright by watching a 30-year-old episode of St. Elsewhere on a copy of a videotape. It doesn't make any sense. There need to be outlets for creativity, for archiving, for historical study, and they don't exist right now.
Yeah, the best places I think are like archive or even like museums do a better job of allowing content like this to exist and be curated. But again, it's behind a paywall, it's behind a foundation. That's the only protected way it can exist in as a digital recording. And it's really a shame because there's so much in culture and in ads about just seeing how companies and brands have changed over the years. And you really have an amazing treasure trove of stuff. But it's a real problem finding where you can share it, where you can allow people to see it and work on it. But, for them to do that in a legal way and in a public way. All of the current platforms are just terrible for that. They will completely obliterate any aspiration to use people's knowledge and enthusiasm to really capture and find out what's there and then talk about it. There could be all kinds of things in it.
You mentioned archive.org, and thank God for the Internet Archive, because if that weren't around, there would be so much that would be lost permanently. The thing is, it's the exception. It should be the rule. Internet Archive should be something that we all take an interest in because BBS is from the past, which is, Jason Scott got involved, textfiles.com. Preserving all that is such a valuable service. It's something that if we don't do it, it'll be lost forever. And, okay, you may protect your copyright, but you lose history like, you've never done before and who gains from that?
But if you designed your own platform, if you really invested in making it specifically the way you want to share it and leverage community interest the way you intend, it should not be that you need the backing of archive.org and a lot of people to protect you in doing that. Say you're just a student or you put together a small site and you're building this whole thing yourself, and then you're told by outside entities that you need to do filtering or that you need to not host something or your site's seized just because a couple conglomerates decide you ought not exist or they don't want to talk about their past, you know, and there you are. You really can only find refuge in these organizations. And that's really bad because they, I think Jason and Archive.org would admit they have their work cut out for them, you know, and people should be free to share and create and do the archiving that needs to be done so that it's sort of ready for curation when it gets to Archive.org.
You know, a thought here. With all the money these companies make with their copyright and control of the internet, a percentage should go to Internet Archive to preserve and maintain. I just came up with that idea, but I think that should be mandated.
And fight their lawyers.
Building on this issue that Carlos brought up with regard to sharing, you know, a real foreseeable but unintentional consequence of this content filtering law, if it's passed at a plenary vote of the EU and it's transposed into national legislation, what we're already seeing with GDPR to an extent is this further balkanization of the internet, where because of these burdensome rules, certain sites and dialogue and content are not available to people in the EU because of these restrictions. We're going to see that in California with the California Consumer Privacy Act. And what I fear would happen is certain forums, certain sites where content is exchanged and discussed will be prevented from being displayed in the EU because of these particular rules. That balkanization is not good for free speech, not good for dialogue, not good for the internet at all.
Yeah, and I think the RIAA and the MPAA, the organizations that say that these filters are mandatory, are huge hypocrites because they claim that if we don't have a strict copyright, so we won't have incentives to create more culture, when in fact they're the ones, their filters are destroying that vast pieces of culture and preventing them from getting out.
Yeah, let's give it a try. See if it really does stifle creativity. I wager it doesn't. All right, that's going to have to be the last word. Write to us, oth@2600.com. We'd love to hear from you. In the meantime, stay awake and send us your feedback and challenge the system and all that good stuff. We'll see you next time. Good night.
You're tuned to listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica Radio. This is WBAI in New York, and you just heard, what was the name of that program?
Off the Hook.
All About Hacking? Off the Hook. Coming up next, the Personal Computer Show. Stay tuned.
Hello, I'm Sierra Holman at WBAI in New York, reminding you that the New York State primaries are coming up this Thursday, September 13th. New York State polling sites open at 6 a.m. and they'll stay open until 9 p.m. For more information on where to vote in your district, head to vote.nyc.gov. You can also call the phone bank at 1-866-VOTE-NYC. You know, many people complain about public transportation, unaffordable rents, the high cost of living, and some worry about police accountability and the qualities of our schools. Well, now's the time to do something about it. Remember, local government directly affects you. Be the change you want to see in your community and vote this Thursday.
Hello, I'm David Rothenberg. Last spring, we presented Richard Hola's spellbinding show, simply called E, at the Commons right here at 388 Atlantic Avenue in Brooklyn. Because it was not only a sellout, but Richard earned a standing ovation, we determined that E merited a second showing. E, just the letter, it stands for Edith, the pugnacious and fascinating New York woman in this tale. It'll play again at the Commons on Sunday, September 16th at 3 o'clock. Tickets are $20 a person, a benefit for listener-sponsored BAI. WBAI will continue to be in on the start of this one-of-a-kind raconteur's newest and most vivid offering. Richard Hola's E, Sunday, September 16th at 3 p.m. here, right below our Crystal Studios at 388 Atlantic Avenue, Brooklyn. For ticket information, you can go to our website, wbai.org. See you at the Commons.
Today is September the 12th, 2018. Do you know who has your personal data? Let me ask the question a little differently. Do you know who's using your personal data? Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. This is the original personal computer radio show of all things computing. I'm Hank Key. My colleague is Joe King. Podcasts of the programs available on wbai.org/archive. We're also on PRN.FM and on our website, PCRadioshow.org. We are on WBAI-FM 99.5 New York, on the radio, and PRN.FM on the internet each Wednesday with essentially the same program, except when WBAI is in a membership drive, the programs are a little different. There was a time when having a MySpace profile was cool. However, the arrival of Facebook, with its simple interface and lack of ads, toppled MySpace completely, falling as quickly as it had rose. MySpace went the way of the telegram. Facebook today is the dominant social media platform. But with the coming of newer, hipper apps like Instagram and Snapchat, Facebook is facing a challenge. A commonly cited reason for leaving Facebook among teenagers is the influx of parents and older people on the website. Facebook, however, is still the most popular social media platform by far amongst people outside the 12 to 17-year-old demographic. However, when you're a teenager, there's nothing less cool in the world than your parents. Why on earth would you want to share a social media platform with them? Millennials today make up nearly a quarter of the total U.S. population. The presence of relatives on Facebook has deterred teenagers from acting like themselves while posting, wary that whatever they say will be brought up at the dinner table or at a future job interview. Teenagers have to moderate what they post so much that Facebook might as well be LinkedIn. For today's teenagers, their presence on social media is crucial for their social status. They don't want to present themselves as some sort of sanitized adult figure. They're teenagers. They want to seem rebellious, cool, unique, and aloof. Snapchat has stolen Facebook's teenagers' users away. The main appeal of Snapchat to teenagers is its impulsivity and lack of permanence. The Snap Stories features, which allow users to upload videos or photos that last for 24 hours before being deleted, is incredibly popular among teenagers because users are encouraged to post more spur-of-the-moment content as opposed to Facebook's timeline model encouraging the posting of more significant content. People aren't going to post that shaky 3-second clip that they took of their cute dog on Facebook, but it would be perfectly normal to see it on a Snap story. By encouraging off-the-cuff mundane content, Snapchat constantly stays in the back of the user's head. Facebook recognizes this design philosophy and copied it wholesale with its Moments feature. Facebook's core design is that of a timeline displaying significant events or content chronological on a user profile. Snapchat is the exact opposite, being a social media platform that focuses on content that is in the moment. For teenagers who constantly ebb and flow between what they see as cool, having embarrassing or uncool posts erase themselves only to be replaced by cooler and newer content is highly appealing. Snapchat currently stands as the most popular social media platform among people 12 to 17 years of age. Reports from eMarketer suggest that Snapchat will gain new users in that demographic by 2022, while at the same time, Facebook will be losing teenage users. Facebook owns Instagram, but the migration from the lucrative Facebook platform is a problem for the company. There is the trust factor. Facebook subscribers have become the product for Facebook's revenue. Snapchat was founded in 2011. Snapchat is an image and video messaging application. It was initially launched in July of 2011. Snapchat is one of Facebook's greatest threats by having photos disappear. About a year ago, Instagram was launched as a near-identical version of one of Snapchat's main features, Stories. The new Instagram feature had the same name and similar look. Friends could share photos and video updates on their profiles that would disappear after 24 hours. The launch of Instagram Stories was just the beginning. Over the course of this past year, Instagram has added face filters, location tags, stickers, drawing tools, and disappearing photo messages in what has turned into a fierce competition between the two social apps. By now, Instagram has eclipsed Snapchat in daily users. The Facebook-owned Instagram app announced in June that it had more than 250 million users creating stories every day. More people are using Instagram stories than the entirety of the Snapchat app, which has a total of almost 170 million daily users as the end of May. The battle wages on. Whether Facebook can overtake and eliminate Snapchat is tied to Facebook's ability to regain the public trust. Our opening statement for the broadcast is, do you know who has your personal data? More importantly, do you know how they are using your personal data? And more pointedly, have you become a product? Since the demise of net neutrality, U.S. telecoms have increased the amount of throttling they impose on customers trying to watch mobile video through services like Netflix and YouTube. According to a new group of researchers at Northeastern University and the University of Massachusetts Amherst. The study, the findings of which were published first by Bloomberg, reveals the extent to which companies like AT&T and Verizon have taken to limit data speeds for customers. All four big carriers in the United States now offer unlimited data plans that restrict streaming video on mobile devices to 480p. By default, in an apparent effort to manage network traffic, reduce congestion, and ensure that these companies don't need to upgrade network infrastructure unless absolutely necessary. The research was conducted by getting around 100,000 people to sign up for a mobile app called WEHE, that's W-E-H-E, which monitor network traffic for participating users to determine when an app experiences differentiation, as the study puts it. The app conducted around 500,000 tests, monitoring over 2,000 service providers in 161 countries. AT&T and Verizon were by far the most egregious throttlers, differentiating delivery speeds for streaming. Most of this differentiation equates to throttling. The study concludes, meaning U.S. carriers are slowing the delivery speed of the data based on the type of data it is. And this is supposed to be a violation of one of the principles of modern net neutrality principles. AT&T and Verizon do not hide that their networks are actively throttling distinct traffic types, although the carriers prefer phrases like network management. Terms like prioritization and other euphemism that disguise the fact that data speeds are artificially slowed down. Right now, most unlimited data plans from the big U.S. carriers will throttle all traffic